Chapter 3. Over the next few days, Secundus thought a great deal about what Miss Absalom had said to him, about magic as a form of diplomacy. He was familiar with the many ways in which magicians made petitions to various persons, and naturally he knew of the Raven King's many contracts with the earth and sky of England, but he had never before thought of English magic in quite this way. He supposed he had not thought of himself as having the authority to negotiate with England, or with any of its component parts, even so much as a rosebush or a bramble. He was, after all, no Raven King. He did not have anything to offer England, apart from an occasionally poorly composed sonnet or a jar of blackberry jam. Even Archibald Unsigg the Raven seemed at times unconvinced of Secundus's mastery. He eyed Secundus as though considering that perhaps he ought to be the owner and Secundus ought to be the pet in the cage. Yet Miss Absalom obviously felt he held a negotiating position. Miss Absalom had been very encouraging to him, and he was inclined to think she did not dissemble. So Secundus began to consider how he might go about negotiation. It was quite plain to him that Childermas's method of intimidation and sternness would not suit him well. The snail, for instance, which he had very strictly admonished not to consume his garden, had now made its home amongst the rhubarb plants. Secundus sighed heavily when he saw this. He crouched down close to the snail. "Sir," he said, "this is most inconvenient. I shall have to remove you from the garden if you cannot restrict yourself to the weeds. I am very fond of rhubarb. I plan to make a cake with it." He became aware that he had the snail's attention, and that in some sense he had the rhubarb's attention as well. "Perhaps you could feast upon the hairgrass," he suggested to the snail. "I have no particular use for it, and it keeps sending up patches where I would not have them grow. Would that do?" The snail considered that it would, so long as Secundus would not exorcise his raven in the garden. The presence of the raven was why there were not more snails. "That seems reasonable," Secundus said. "Yes, I think it will do very well. And if I see any more weeds, I shall inform you of their location." The rhubarb was very pleased with Secundus's bargain. It did not mind being eaten. It viewed itself as something in the nature of a collective being made up of a unity of many generations of rhubarb. It wished for Secundus to ensure the life of its future generations through careful and sympathetic replanting, which snails did not regard, being limited creatures. Therefore, the rhubarb viewed Secundus as its benefactor, and would henceforth put special effort into its ripening. Secundus left the garden, feeling that this had been a very successful encounter, and also that possibly the rhubarb regarded him as its king, or at the very least a feudal lord and overseer, which did not really suit his principles, he being far more inclined to a constitutional system, but which he supposed he could manage. He did not know if what he had done was precisely magic, but he found that he was satisfied by it. That evening, as he was enjoying a light supper that his housekeeper had left for him, a portion of jugged hare and some very nice bread, which, however, left him thinking rather longingly of Miss Absalom's iced cakes, he was interrupted by a knock at the door. It was the same boy from the village who had come to inform Secundus about the drunken magician. This time he had come to inform Secundus about an angered water spirit. Secundus asked him, "What is your name?" "Jeremy, sir," said the boy. "Jeremy Hopper. They always send me on account if I'm not afraid of you." "Afraid of me?" Secundus asked in astonishment, in the act of putting on his coat. "Surely you mean afraid of the other magician, my colleague, Mr. Childermas." "Oh, no, sir," said Jeremy Hopper. "We have known Mr. Childermas this year and more. He would not hurt a soul. He's all powder and no shot, as my father would say." As they hurried off, Secundus reflected on this astounding description of Childermas. He had cause to be aware that Childermas was certainly not all powder and no shot. Childermas was enough of a shot to have once occasioned someone to shoot him, and to have caused dear meek Mr. Honeyfoot to have strongly considered it. It was true that Childermas was also a great deal of powder. A significant amount of this powder tended to be visible under his fingernails, but shot there certainly was. Secundus, on the other hand, was neither shot nor powder, so why on earth would someone be afraid of him? "Because you are silent and remote and fix your mind upon the cosmic matters," said Jeremy Hopper. "You're always thinking about them, the cosmic matters. So you might at any moment quarrel with the dark or cause a lightning storm in the village." "I might certainly not," Secundus said, taken aback. "That would be most unlike me." Jeremy Hopper looked a little disappointed by this answer. "You might cause the river to be filled with horrible sea monsters," he suggested. "I do not know of any horrible sea monsters," Secundus said. "And if I did, I certainly should not wish them to fill a river. Why should I? The logic of these theories seems very thin." There was a long pause as they crossed the market square of the village. "You might become enraged," Jeremy Hopper said. He sounded rather sulky. You might work yourself into a magical tempest. I'm sorry to disappoint you, Segundus said. Truly. But such an event is very unlikely to occur. I am the most even-tempered of fellows. If anyone, it is Mr. Childermas who might work himself into a magical tempest. He stopped, because they had arrived at the little mill pond where Jeremy Hopper claimed the angered water spirit to be. The sun was setting behind a far ridge, casting mauve light and blue shadows across the placid scene. There was no sign of the water spirit as such. However, as soon as they had left the road, the sound of birdsong had ceased, which made the tableau an eerie one. Indeed, there was no sound at all. Not the wind rustling in the bushes, not the hum of dragonflies, not crickets calling to one another in the bushes. There was only the water lapping in the mill pond. Segundus felt very uneasy about this indeed. "What is it that the water spirit did?" he asked Jeremy Hopper. He supposed he ought to have asked this to begin with. He had assumed the water spirit was more or less simply splashing about in an angry fashion. Jeremy Hopper's eyes lit up. "It stole 3 cows," he said. "Just sucked them up in a sort of water spout. Do you suppose it crunched their bones for bread?" "You are a very gruesome young man," Segundus told him severely. "We must hope it is not. I shall try to speak to it and see what it wants." He approached the mill pond. "Excuse me, sir," he called out towards it. "My name is John Segundus. I am the local magician. I have come to discover why you have stolen these good people's cows. Perhaps you did not realize that such an act is most improper." The water lapped sullenly against the shoreline. Segundus had a sense that he was being attended to, however reluctantly, but there was no response. He tried again. "I often find," he said, "that I'm more amenable to conversation when I have a nice cup of tea. Would you like a cup of tea? Perhaps some cake? I have a very nice cloudberry cake back at my home." There was a pause. Water seeped up under Segundus's shoes. He had a strong sense of a sulky voice telling him that if he were a magician, he would know that it was improper to negotiate after sundown. Certainly far more improper than it had been for the voice to steal the cows, which anyway he had not stolen, but removed at their own, that is, the cows' request, for their lives were very dull, and they grew tired of being milked every day, and they wished to visit the other lands. Segundus lifted his feet up gingerly, attempting to preserve them from the water. "I am sorry to have made such an inappropriate suggestion in that case. Perhaps I might return tomorrow in the morning, and at that hour bring you some tea and cake, and then we might chat." The water spirit grudgingly admitted that this was possible. It withdrew into its little pond, leaving Segundus's shoes sodden and smelling of moss. So the next morning, Segundus bumbled his way back down to the mill pond with a wide hat on and a large hamper carried on his arm. It was raining, a light warm summer mist, and the ground beneath his shoes was soggy and wet. It was not his idea of preferable picnic weather, but he supposed that a water spirit might have different standards. Perhaps the damp day and drizzle would have made it better tempered. But if a river spirit thought a damp day was the finest weather, would it still enjoy a cup of tea? Segundus pondered this rather profound question. Jeremy Hopper, though his presence was not required, had chosen to observe the proceedings from the branch of a nearby apple tree, where he sat swinging his legs and eating small green apples that Segundus suspected did not belong to him. Segundus spread a checkered cloth upon the damp ground and produced a china teapot. He had cast a spell upon it to keep it hot, and another so the china would not be chipped. He had also brought china cups and saucers, and little china plates for the cake, and silver forks. He felt a bit silly laying out the tea things at the edge of the pond, with rain speckling his coat sleeves, but he was determined not to allow this to affect his behavior. "Now then," he said to the water spirit, "do you take any sugar?" The water spirit took 2 lumps of sugar. It did seem somewhat appeased by the damp weather, or perhaps by Segundus's cloudberry cake. As Segundus sipped his tea, it complained at length about its life. It was dreadfully bored. No one ever spoke to it except the cows and the geese, and occasionally a few tadpoles that turned into frogs. The earth spoke, but it did not speak the same language. And the sky, well, whoever got any sense out of skies? In the old days, there had been magicians everywhere, traveling here and there on John Osglass's business, or getting themselves into trouble, or needing favors. But now they all stayed in York or Leeds or London. No one ever needed favors anymore. The water spirit had been very happy to send the cows to the other lands, because they had asked him so politely, and it had been nice to be needed again. "I see," Segundus said, listening sympathetically, and folding his arms about his knees. "Well, I cannot say that you have done wrongly. I find it very difficult myself, being the only magician in the locality. It can be a dull business, and no mistaking. But, you know, the cows were not really free to do as they wished. The farmer has put a great deal of work into their upkeep. He has fed them and cared for them. You can see why he is a little put out. The river spirit admitted that perhaps it could see. But, it said petulantly, it was the farmer's own fault for failing to entertain the cows. The farmer did not know, Segundus explained. He is not like you or I. I shall explain to him, and then perhaps he may tell the cows stories, or sing the cows songs, or send them on holidays. He did not really look forward to this conversation, as he could imagine the look on a Yorkshire farmer's face when a magician explained to him that his cows required holidays, but he was willing to undertake it. Oh, very well, the river spirit surrendered with a certain amount of bad humor. It felt, however, that if it did this, Segundus would owe it a favor. Segundus hummed thoughtfully. I don't suppose, he said, that you might be interested in relocation. A short while later, there was a great disturbance in the water, very like a waterspout, and a noise of unhappy mooing emanated from the mill pond. Three large, dappled cows hurtled through the air and landed gently upon the pond's bank, where they lashed their tails and gazed balefully at Segundus. Jeremy Hopper said, You've got old Jack's cows back! They wasn't all horribly gnashed up! Segundus sighed and experienced a strong urge to bury his face in his hands. He turned towards the mill pond. All right, he said. Come along, then. A little wave of water splashed itself meekly into the teapot. Segundus put the lid on the pot and loaded it back into the hamper, accompanied by the chinaware, the forks, and the checkered cloth. What a day it has been, he announced, to no one in particular. Then, clapping his hat onto his head, he was off, leaving Jeremy Hopper to inspect the cows dubiously, prodding them with a suspicious finger, as though he would not at all have been surprised to discover they were sea monsters after all. The water spirit settled very happily into a small pond on the left side of the garden. Segundus labored for most of that day till the pond was dug, and he had laid a flat bed of stones for its base. Then he poured out the water from the teapot, and felt a very peculiar rush as the water spirit went with it. In a short time he had filled the rest of the pond as well, and it was bubbling contentedly as the snail investigated it. That evening, as Segundus enjoyed a small glass of sherry and read a new magical journal that had just arrived from London, the journal endorsed making use of the principles of natural science to investigate and classify English magic. Segundus rather wondered what its editors would make of the water spirit, or indeed of cows wishing to go on holiday. He was startled to hear the unmistakable sound of a horse approaching in the lane. Frowning and wondering if the village had experienced further magical trouble, Segundus left his comfortable dining room and went to the gate. He was astonished to see that the horse he had heard was Brewer, and that Childermas was astride him. "Mr. Segundus," said Childermas forbiddingly. "What are you doing here?" Segundus asked, rather rudely. "I heard there was trouble hereabouts," Childermas said. "I thought it best I keep my eye on it." "Well, there's no need for that," Segundus said. "I have resolved it already." This seemed to give Childermas pause. "Have you now?" he said at length. It may surprise you to learn that I have some small skill at magic, and also that I have other skills, many of them unknown to you, sir, many of them skills which you yourself are lacking. This gave Childermas even further pause. He peered at Segundus closely, looking very suspicious. There's something different about you, he said. What have you been up to? Segundus said, I have been resolving magical problems, with a good deal of success. I have convinced the rose bushes to bloom, and instituted a number of reforms to my garden, and I have fed your slice of cloudberry cake to a water spirit. He lives in the little pond to your right. He is a more congenial conversationalist than you have ever been. No, that's not it. Childermas frowned at Segundus some more. Are you not going to invite me in? Segundus crossed his arms over his chest. Why should I? Because I have ridden a very long way. For a moment, Segundus tried to summon up the strength to refuse him. He thought indignantly, no one asked him to ride a very long way. He did not bother to send word. It is his own fault if he sleeps in a field. But he was not the sort of man who could be so firm-hearted. He sighed heavily. All right, he said, you may come in, but I am not offering you any sherry. Childermas's mouth quirked in amusement, but he said nothing. Once Brewer was in the stable, and Childermas had settled by the fire with a glass of sherry in his hand, I have ridden a very long way, he had repeated, gazing with a certain profundity of sorrow at the sherry bottle. And Segundus had said, bad-tempered, Oh, very well, but there will be absolutely no cake. Segundus discovered that in addition to his unpleasant demeanor and his dreadful habits, Childermas had brought a large number of magical magazines with him, including several from Edinburgh, which Segundus had not known existed. The two of them therefore passed a very pleasant night, reading quietly and drinking, occasionally offering observations on topics of mutual interest. With Childermas, there was no need to offer pleasantries, since he himself did not observe the art, and Secundus found this quite comfortable. From time to time, he caught Childermas staring at him a little fixedly, as though trying to perceive some unexpected dimension of him, but Childermas said nothing further on the topic of Secundus's apparent alteration. Only, just before they both retired to bed, Childermas said, "I believe you are happy." His tone was one of accusation and displeasure. Secundus considered this statement. "I cannot say for certain," he said at last. "I suppose I am." In his dream that night, he was already naked, stretched out upon a rather sumptuous bed, which had wine-colored sheets and more pillows than he thought was strictly necessary. He was thinking of Miss Absalom, how filthily she kissed him, how her long ginger hair tumbled down her back as she rode his prick, taking it inside her, letting him pierce her where she was hot and wet and tight, the loud cries she made whenever he pleased her, and how very demanding she could become, pressing herself down against him, greedy with desire. Before he knew it, he had taken himself in hand, and his breath was coming fast as he pleasured himself. Then Miss Absalom, also naked, was crawling into the bed, giggling at his guilty look. "Oh, do not stop, do not stop," she said, and gently placed his hand back on his prick. She did not remove her own hand, but guided him to continue touching himself in slow strokes. "Were you thinking about me?" "Yes," he said fervently. "About being inside you, pleasing you, while I..." she said, her eyes heavy-lidded. "While you fucked me, is that what you were going to say?" Secundus could feel himself flush, but he also felt his prick jump. He knew that Miss Absalom felt it as well, for she laughed low and delightedly. "Is that what you would like?" she asked him. She still had not moved her hand. "Yes," he said, hoarse, gazing up at her. "Then come and take me," she said, releasing him and lying back in a seductive pose. Against the dark red sheets of the bed, her skin looked especially soft and creamy, her body like something from a Botticelli painting, though it had also the quality of the English rose to it. Secundus stared at her, breathing hard, his mouth dropping open. Then he was crawling towards her, frantic with desire, and draping himself against her, pushing into her with his prick. It was so good, to be tangled in that double embrace, the hot, wet grip of her body around his prick, and the close, sweet tangle of her limbs around his body, as he pressed her back against the bed. She did not lie still, but instead was in constant motion, her hips rocking forward to him so that on each stroke he was pushed as deep into her body as it was possible for him to go, her hands moving ceaselessly against his chest, his shoulders, his back, stroking in almost an inquisitive manner, as though investigating all the parts of him. Even her toes trailed up and down his legs, the feeling of which had an odd power to arouse him. He, for his part, could not stop himself trying to kiss her, even as the coordination required to do so became so difficult that he was reduced to mouthing shakily at her jawline and her neck. He could have finished quickly, but he did not wish to. He wished to savor every slide of his prick inside her, the way her eyelashes fluttered when he pushed very deep, the short cry she uttered, the disarray of her hair like a cloud of copper silk floss around her head. He had to stop and move slowly, closing his eyes, pushing in very carefully, one stroke at a time. But this made her impatient, and she pulled him flush up against her, then pushed him forcefully over so that she was now astride him. This robbed him of his breath, for she then kissed him passionately and immediately began to ride him, rolling her hips while keeping him pressed inside her, working him according to her own pleasure. She grew increasingly vocal, more so when she reached her hand down to pleasure herself. "Oh," she moaned, sliding sharply up and down him. "Yes, you feel perfect, so deep inside me." Secundus reached his hands out to touch her breasts, half to pleasure her and half because he could not resist them. He loved the feel of her nipples hard between his fingers, the small swell of each breast under his hand. But his touch did pleasure her, and in a very short time she came to her climax upon him. He barely managed to hold off his own climax so long, and finished, in fact, perhaps a beat before she did, so that they shuddered through the aftermath more or less together, breathing hard and touching one another gently, given over to that small kind of flinch that arises after orgasm, like the small shocks before sleep, perhaps marking one's transition between waking and dream. Secundus stretched his arms out languorously, but was in no hurry to move her. He gazed up at her rather foolishly, feeling enormously happy and very comfortable. "That was lovely," he said. "I loved that. I..." She kissed him very sweetly, lowering herself to lie curled beside him with her head upon his shoulder. "Yes," she agreed airily. "It was very lovely. I thought we were going to talk about spell work, but then you showed up naked in my bed and all thought of spells flew right out of my mind." Segunda said dryly, "I do not believe that." He had a great deal of experience with what it means to be a magician. "Well, most thoughts of spells flew right out of my mind. Quite a few. Perhaps half my thoughts of spells. A few remain. Shall I teach you a spell now?" "Oh, I would like that." "All right, let's see." She drummed her fingers thoughtfully upon his thigh, which sent a pleasant shiver through him. "A spell to banish dust from your house? A spell to make a star tell you all that it is seeing? A spell to cause someone to speak in sonnets?" Segundus was quite taken by the idea of causing Childermas to speak in sonnets, and for a moment he strongly considered it. However, he had a feeling that Childermas would not care to be enchanted, so with some regret he said, "Perhaps the first. It seems very practical." "It is, but very complicated, because it involves every object in the house. Every object past, present, and future. You must account for all of them." Miss Absalom launched into a long, complicated, and interesting theoretical explanation. It had to do with webs of obligation, which she called liege cloths, for she was in the habit of picturing magic as weaving. Segundus thought a little drowsily that Childermas would be interested in this, and that he might see a way to use it upon the roof, which was prone to leaking in various places when rainstorms came. He had just asked Miss Absalom what he thought was a fascinating question about obligations between the past and the present, when he had the strange sense that a bird was whistling directly into his ear, though there did not seem to be such a bird in the dream. He frowned and shook his head, but the bird song was not silenced. "Oh, bother," he said vaguely, "it's going to wake me up." Miss Absalom made a noise of complaint and nuzzled against him, stretching a leg across his body. "How inconvenient. I was almost going to propose that we go again." Segundus groaned aloud, for now he very much wanted this to happen. Her small hand was wandering towards his prick, which had begun to rise at the thought of having her once more. "Tonight," he said desperately. "Come back tonight, will you, please?" He did not receive her answer, for he woke then. A chorus of birds was singing in extremely shrill tones outside his window. He did not recall ever having heard such a racket before. He dressed in a very bad temper, as the birds went on singing, and thudded down to the kitchen in search of some tea. Childermas was there, eating ginger biscuits. He had piled the kitchen table with library books. He turned a very suspicious gaze on Segundus, eyes following him about the kitchen. "Why is there so much magic in this house at night?" he asked. Segundus turned an innocent look on him. "I've no idea what you mean." "I have noticed it before. At night, this house fills up with magic." "Why are you creeping about my house at night, making such measurements?" "I am not," Childermas said, "creeping about your house at night. It is a disturbing habit, this creeping about. Do you also stand outside my bedroom door?" "I do not creep about your house. Nothing about your bedroom is the slightest bit interesting to me." Childermas affected to return his attention to his book, ignoring Segundus, though he appeared a little flustered. Segundus set himself to brewing tea. "It is a very magical house," he said at length. "It was Miss Absalom's, after all. I dare say you are only sensing the house itself." "Perhaps," Childermas allowed, but he did not seem convinced. Over the course of the morning, he directed a number of skeptical looks at Segundus, which grew more and more confounded throughout the day.